Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you're listening to you with your host, Avenger Satanus, and the Beast.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Beastino. This is my co-host, Avenger Satanus. Avenger, how are you today?
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, this is a Warlock Asylum.
Awesome. Oh, okay. We got Jason King on the line, too.
Yeah, okay, that's good. How is everybody?
Good, good.
Well. How are you today?
I'm good, yeah. I got a chance to talk to Hot Beast Venger over the email, so yeah, I'm looking forward to the show, and would like to thank the Cult of Cthulhu for providing this forum, as well as Jason666King. You know, I got a chance to look at his book and everything, so it's pretty good stuff. Yeah, it's pretty good stuff. Yeah, that's about it. I was just actually running out to go get a beer, you know. Just let me just hurry back up in time to check this out. Yeah.
So. Well, we're glad to have you on, and, you know, anytime we can spark debate and try to get at the truth of something with, you know, discussion and, you know, trying to see other people's views and whatever, that's all good.
We love that. Now, can you guys hear me well, or?
What's that?
Can you hear me well? Is my audio coming in pretty well?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can hear you just fine.
Okay, all right, because I was kind of tuning in and out. I might put on my headphones for a second, but,
Okay.
Yeah, you know, my earplug headphones. Give me one second. Hold on one second. I'm sorry.
All right. In the meantime, let's just verify, Mr. King, you're on the line?
Indeed I am. How's everybody doing?
Awesome.
Doing well. Excited.
Okay, I'm good, yeah. How is that? Is that good?
Yeah, you actually sound much better there.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, because I was kind of in the hallway just coming in, so.
All right. Well, we're kind of pressed for time here, so what I want to do is just give a brief outline of what's going to go down here so that everybody who's listening knows, and then you guys also know.
Okay.
The actual, we know what the actual proposition is. The proposition being, let me get to this real quick. Mm-hmm. The proposition being the Simon Necronomicon is dependent on the mythos of H.P. Lovecraft. Jason King will be arguing pro for that, and you will be arguing the con on that.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to go down like this. There's going to be five-minute openings, one for the pro, one for the con, five-minute rebuttals, one for the pro, one for the con. Then we'll have a little Blitzkrieg segment, which will be about 10 minutes in total, but there'll be two-minute intervals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the end of those 10 minutes, there's going to be two-minute closings for both the pro and the con. Now, you guys will hear this sound when it's time. Okay?
I didn't catch that.
Into the, what's that?
That sound
wasn't loud enough.
Not loud enough?
No, I don't think I'll be able to stop speaking. Make it a little louder enough.
Sure,
yeah, no, that was great.
Just kidding. Anyway, okay. So, on to the first opening. on my mark, okay? Go.
Okay, I'm assuming that's going to be me since I'm taking the pro position. For those of you out there who may not know what the Simon Necronomicon is, I came up with a little example to maybe help put it into context. What I want you to imagine is, imagine that I was making the following claim. Imagine I said that I had found, or that somebody had given to me, a 10th century codex of the Old Testament. And it was just like the regular Old Testament that we had, except for a few peculiarities. For example, Moses battles the Jabberwock in Pharaoh's court instead of Pharaoh's magicians. The Cheshire Cat is the one that appears to Noah and instructs him to build the ark. Instead of Abram being sacramentalized with bread and wine by Melchizedek, he actually has a tea party with the Mad Hatter. Oh, and it's not Adam and Eve, it's Adam and Alice, and she was tempted by a white rabbit, not a serpent. Now, if all this sounds kind of silly, it sounds silly to me too, but that's essentially the claim that was made by one Simon, a.k.a. Peter Lavenda, in the Simon Necronomicon. Essentially what we're left with is a hodgepodge of Mesopotamian mythos, which has characters from a fictional set of stories authored by H.P. Lovecraft, who was a horror writer that was active in about the mid to late 1920s, early 1930s. And you have these characters from his stories that are inserted into Sumerian myths, all with the claim that this is an ancient text. So we're doing a disservice to both the text themselves and also to the artistic creativity of H.P. Lovecraft. Now, on to the specifics of said influence and dependence. I would argue that this is a cover-to-cover influence. If we start front cover, we have the Necronomicon as the title of the work. The Necronomicon was actually invented by H.P. Lovecraft in the story The Hound, which was written in 1922, published in 1924. There are no instances of this word appearing in any text anywhere prior to this date. And that includes the Simon Necronomicon simply because the book was never authenticated by anyone. No one has ever seen the supposed text that it is based on. Cover to cover, we go to the back cover. The first two words on the back cover are H.P. Lovecraft. If you flip open the front cover, you'll notice that the very first two words on the facing page are Cthulhu Calls, which is a reference, of course, to the Call of Cthulhu, the first story in which the mythos was introduced as a whole. The first two sections of the introduction deal almost exclusively with H.P. Lovecraft and his connection to perhaps Aleister Crowley's writings and also Sumerian mythos in general. He has the most work listed in the bibliography of the book. And getting to specifics, there's a word that Venger Satanus finds, oftentimes to use called Ia, 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 Cthulhu, Fatagan. This is an untranslated emphatic, which we don't really know what it means, but it was invented by H.P. Lovecraft in a work that he wrote under another name or for another author in 1927, published in 1928, called The Last Test, and this is also when Shub-Niggurath is introduced as a character. I'll get back to that in a minute. Ia occurs 108 times in the Simon Necronomicon, also as an untranslated emphatic, and is never used prior to The Last Test, again written by H.P. Lovecraft in 1927, is never used prior to this date in any text that can be verified by any historian, at least as an untranslated emphatic. Cthulhu, 22 mentions in the Simon Necronomicon. This is a character that H.P. Lovecraft created in 1926, published in 1928 in The Call of Cthulhu. There are no, again, recorded instances of this word appearing in any text prior to this date. H.P. Lovecraft did invent the character. There's also five separate mentions in the Simon Necronomicon of Cthulhu. Should be the same thing, and then again we're treated to certain things such as dreaming, imprisoned, and these are all topoi that were developed with regard to the character Cthulhu by H.P. Lovecraft himself. We have Azagthoth mentioned 14 times, also described as blind, mad, etc., and this, of course, would be Lovecraft's Azathoth. created by him in 1922, not published until 1938 in the little short story Azathoth. Again, this word does not appear at any date prior to 1922. When Lovecraft created it, there are no texts that have been verified by any historians, etc., that have this word in it. Okay,
now it's thank you, Mr. King. It's now Warlock Asylum's turn to open.
Hey, how are you guys doing out there? Can you hear me well?
Yep, we can hear you perfectly.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to get into a little bit. I'm an old school black magician, you know, before the iPod black magician era. What Mr. King said was very valuable, so I'm going to give you a little bit of background as briefly as I can. From my own experience and from people who were actually there at the time that this whole thing was going down. Basically, during the early 70s to the late 70s, after the FBI infiltrated the Black Panthers, the next step was the OTO. The OTO, different than today's cookie-cutter magician, these brothers were influencing the underworld. They were involved in extortion, a lot of different things. It was like a mafia. You know, they ruled the underworld. During that time period, there was a rare book hype. And the reason being is because people would steal books. They wouldn't risk their lives stealing books over anything. You know what I'm saying? They would sell them or auction them to black magicians of high influence, you know, who was trying to accumulate power. During that time period, there was a grimoire, ancient Mesopotamian grimoire, that a lot of people saw. It wasn't Greek. It wasn't the Necronomicon. If the king is right about that, it wasn't the Necronomicon. Now, what happened was Herman Slater and three other Thelemites in the Inner Order translated parts of it. The gatewalking rituals came from the grimoire, some parts of the Urilitech, a little bit of the Book of Calling. Other parts were added in by Peter Lavender. Peter Lavender was the front man. He was the patsy. Okay, at the time the Fed start coming down on them, a little bit before the Satanic Panic, what occurred was that Slater was like, oh, we can still make some money off of this, whatever the case may be. This is actually text because that was an underground buzz. People didn't care about Lovecraft in that sense. Slater was a fan of Lovecraft. Well, it wasn't like Lovecraft has this big following of people looking for this book. A couple of heads were. Kenneth Grant started getting a little bit into the notions of comparison. Okay. At that point in time, the text was burnt. The Thelemites, holding to their code of secrecy, was not allowed by their pledge or their oath, you know, to reveal what was really going on. Lavender was brought in. His role was more or less like to read up on Lovecraft. He is an occult historian. And to simulate some of the terms so they won't get busted down by the Fed. Now, you notice that during the Satanic Panic in 1984, Lavender goes to Malaysia. He's funded to Malaysia. This is real information. Okay, as far as IA is concerned, IA, that appears in Waddell's Sumerian Dictionary. It comes from the word IAH. It is a prehistoric word that's found it. It's documented. You can look it up in his Sumerian Dictionary, even if you go to like a Google search. To show you the code of silence that was implemented, the text in the book's introduction, Mr. King is a good author. He put out a couple of books. High Priest Vincent Santanis is also author of a few works himself. The name Crowley appears in the text invertedly the 93rd current, 39 times. Now, everyone knows it's an author. You're not going to bring someone who has nothing to do with a text or no Thelemite influence into a text in its introduction 39 times. Like, you're not going to just mention, like, I have a book. I'm not mentioning any of the Sumerian deities or the ancient ones of my land against the Necronomicon over 39 times in the book's introduction, unless it has pertinent relevance or it's coded for those people that know. You know, words like Cthulhu and stuff like that, to show you how deep the Thelemite influence goes, I'm going to read a section to you from the book Outer Gateways under the same topic as it's called Cthulhu, which is spelled the same way as Cthulhu is spelled, but instead of having the K,
Mr. King, it is now your rebuttal.
Okay, just really quick, on to the point of IAH, it is not used as an untranslated emphatic, as in ya-ya, the way it is in the Simon Necronomicon and also in the mythos of H.P. Lovecraft. Now, we can find, of course, IAO being used in Gnostic rites, etc., but this was a being, not an untranslated emphatic. So, back to what I was saying earlier to continue, because I got cut off by that nice buzzer sound. Ishnigarab 5 mentions, also created in the last test as before, Zaster, which was actually Haster that was created by Ambrose Bierce, I believe, in Hiatia the Shepherd in 1893, but picked up by Robert Chambers in his King in Yellow 2 years later, and Robert Chambers was very influential upon H.P. Lovecraft, who took that same idea and put it into his own mythic story. So here we have three different authors using something that they obviously ripped off from some grimoire that they'd never seen before. I doubt it. The Urilia text, which is actually the Rilia text, was created by August Derleth, who was a Lovecraft collaborator and also his publisher, in The Return of Haster, 1939, which was a couple years after Lovecraft's actual death. The Rilia text does not actually figure into any of Lovecraft's work, so here we have a fourth author that had to have known about this supposed text, this supposed grimoire that nobody's ever seen, and nobody still has ever seen. I mean, you can make hyperbole about, well, so many people saw it, and tell these nice little stories about, well, you know, it was like the FBI and, you know, the mafia back then, whatever. None of that's ever been verified by anyone. But I guess that's kind of the point. Now, what I want to do is I want to examine something from the Testimony of the Mad Arab. And what I'm going to be doing is, this is actually a very poorly written Lovecraftian horror piece. And I've come up with three different parallels that I want to read. First, I'm going to be reading from the Simon Necronomicon. That would be the Testimony of the Mad Arab, the first part. I'm going to read a quote from there, and then I'm going to read a quote that parallels almost exactly from Lovecraft's own work. So, from the Simon Necronomicon, "The wolves carry my name in their midnight speeches, and that quiet, subtle voice is summoning me from afar, and a voice much closer will shout into my ear with unholy impatience. The weight of my soul will decide its final resting place. Before that time, I must put down here all that I can concerning the horrors that stalk without and which lie in wait at the door of every man, for this is the ancient arcana that has been handed down of old, but which has been forgotten by all but a few men, the worshippers of the ancient ones. May their names be blotted out." And now, from the H.P. Lovecraft story, this would be, I believe, The Forgotten City. "Only the grim, brooding desert gods know what really took place, what indecipherable struggles and scrambles in the dark I endured, or what Abaddon guided me back to life, where I must always remember and shiver in the night wind, till oblivion or worse claims me. Monstrous, unnatural, colossal was the thing, too far beyond all the ideas of man to be believed, except in the silent, damnable small hours of the morning when one cannot sleep." Okay, now, sorry to bore people with this, but the parallels are just almost completely striking. From the Testimony of the Mad Arab, the first part, "But now, after 1,001 moons of the journey, the Maxim rip at my heels and the Rabishu pull at my hair. Lamashta opens her dread jaws. Azagthoth gloats blindly at his throne. Cthulhu raises his head and stirs up the veils of sunken Varlorni up through the abyss and fixes his stare upon me. Wherefore I must with haste write this book, lest my end come sooner than I had prepared." Now, from the Lovecraft story, The Hound, this is the final paragraph of that work. "Madness rides the star wind, claws and teeth sharpened on centuries of corpses, dripping death astride a bacchanal of bats, from the night-black ruins of buried temples of Belial. Now, at the baying of that dead, fleshless monstrosity grows louder and louder, and the stealthy whirring and flapping of those accursed web wings circles closer and closer. I shall seek with my revolver the oblivion, which is my only refuge from the unnamed and unnameable." And now, if time permits, the third. And it does not.
All right, now it is the Blitzkrieg Creek round, so we will allow Mr.
Well, actually, I think he gets a rebuttal.
Oh, yeah, he's still got his rebuttal. You're right. I'm sorry. Well, like I said, it's your rebuttal.
Yeah, like I was continuing on with Lavender's role was just to take some of the Lovecraft terminology to hide actually the activity that was going on and to blend it in. What he did was that he took certain aspects of the Lovecraft mythos, certain terminology was adjusted to kind of go with the more of a Thelemic language. Like I mentioned before, this is a Sumerian dictionary, it was written by Waddell, has the word Azag, they conjunct it with the word Thoth as a dispel. Kenneth Grant kind of highlights that even with the word Cthulhu. He mentions in the book Out of the Gateway the following. The word Cthulhu, spelled like Cthulhu with a T in it, was heard by Crowley during an initiation into the Aether of Zaya, which he underwent in Algiers in November 24, 1909. Its appearance in his vision of the 27th heir suggests a precursor of the Necronomicon current. It is probable that the word transcribed by H.P. Lovecraft is Cthulhu, is a variant form of a corruption to Tulu, in much the same way as Corazon is a variant of Khazar or Khorazan. So here he's showing how similarities of Crowley's work with Lovecraft, although when Crowley received this word, I think Lovecraft may have been a young teenager at the time. You know, so it shows that although elements of the H.P. Lovecraft mythos was induced into the work that they were working on sort of to cover it up and to put it out there as a hoax, the initiated members knew exactly what the language of it was going on. Another word that appears is as Mr. Jason King eloquently stated, is Axter in the Ur-Illithet, or Ur-Illa, which is the flame of the goddess, where he mentions this word coming from another story. In my book, The Atlantean Necronomicon, the word Axter breaks down into two words, Ax and Ter. Combined, they mean to cut the umbilical cord, which is the last phase of initiation. When Lovecraft describes Shur-Nagara descending down into the dream of the seven and nine, you notice that in the Necronomicon there's the seven gates, and in the Ur-Illithet there's the nine sigils. Now all these things were done to sort of like make the process seem somewhat like Lovecraft, but in essence the words that are being used do have weight to what was going on in a real mystical or magical paradigm. You know, anyone that knows the initiation of laws, for example, like with the planetary, their correspondences, then you can simulate some aspects of how the character and creating a character with Lovecraft mythology and see the resemblance to an actual mythology that may have worked for people thousands of years ago. So it was easy for Simon to come up, not Simon himself, who was dealing with the translation of the text, which is Freder X, but Peter Lavender, who had a job of blending in the H.P. Lovecraft elements with the Mesopotamian grimoire that they found, which they were later called the Simon Necronomicon, how that sort of thing also works out in itself. Elements of the Mad Testimony of the Mad Arab was taken more or less a lot dealing with Crowley's lifestyle. That's why I mentioned some of the horrors that he faced were similar to the horrors that Crowley faced in terms of the Mad Abbot. One example of this can be seen by his introduction where he compares the Simon Necronomicon to the Book of the Law and how it was interpreted. Now, since that we know the origin of the word Cthulhu without the K precedes Lovecraft, then we can kind of understand like the initiation that he went through when he went into the mountains and he saw this horrific sight, and then he heard the word Cthulhu enter his ear, and then he understood everything that was going on. This is relative to Crowley's interpretation or understanding when AWOS appeared to him.
Okay, it's now time for the Blitzkrieg round. Mr. King, it's your first rebuttal.
Okay, with regard to Kenneth Grant has an overactive imagination when it comes to connecting things. I'm reminded of the Night Side of Eden, where he tries to connect the words eight and height somehow because they have the same letters in them, even though their etymologies are completely different. Kenneth Grant is always to be taken with a grain of salt when he's talking about magical currents, enumeration of those currents, etc. Now, granted, he is a gold mine of occult understanding, but you do have to read between the lines on him a little bit. I don't want to make a point of order here, but I do believe that Mr. Asylum has pretty much said that the proposition that I'm taking is correct. Because we're left with the Simon Necronomicon as a book that you can buy at any bookstore, and the influence of H.P. Lovecraft is there. Again, cover to cover, he does not discount this. That's what I was here to debate, and I think he's pretty much admitted that that's the case. Now, he's trying to say there's an Necronomicon or something that's like a text within the text that he's somehow trying to tease out. But the book itself, the Simon Necronomicon, is dependent on the mythos of H.P. Lovecraft. It's in there. The words are there, cover to cover. Whether or not Crowley himself used a word like Cthulhu is all, you know, anecdotal. There is absolutely no, you know, reference to that in any writings other than the word of Kenneth Grant, which, if we're to take that seriously, obviously Kenneth Grant did study under Aleister Crowley. He was perhaps his successor in the OTO, depending on who you ask. But really, again, that's anecdotal. We have no evidence of that. The word itself was created by H.P. Lovecraft. That is the earliest instance of an imprint in use. And
Mr. Asylum, it's your turn.
Yeah, I just want to continue on just a little bit in the fact that although elements of the Lovecraft mythos were fused in, the gatewalking rituals, which is preliminary to initiation before working with the text, the Book of Calling suggests nothing as far as Lovecraft terminology is concerned as employing in its use until you get to the Arilla text, which is relevant to some other ancient Mesopotamian rites where you have the Hymn of the Ancient Ones that relate to the prayer to the gods of the night, which dealing with the Ozoni, different things of that nature. But for the most part, a person can consistently work with the Simon Necronomicon and its banishing. A lot of my students who work with didn't even know who Lovecraft even was. Actually, to me, personally, on a statistical level, a lot of awareness of Lovecraft and his works came out of the controversy of the Simon Necronomicon. You know, so we have the 50 names of Marduk. We have the gatewalking rituals were actually lends out to Mesopotamia. This is what is mostly talked about throughout the Simon Necronomicon. And they're not talking about the word Ishnagarab, supposed to be Shub-Nagarab, but it's only mentioned like a few times. Azagthoth is mentioned in context, but now knowing that Azag was actually a word for enchanter, according to Wild Elf Dictionary, its conjunction with Thoth means those who, as Lavinia puts in the introduction, those who work with Thoth or enchanters of Thoth. He's talking about Thelemites. You know, so unless a person had that understanding, then they could probably work with the merging of the mythos, which is what Kenneth Grant was working on. However, it's not dependent.
Mr. King?
Okay. It's not just about the literal infestation of this work by H.P. Lovecraft terminology and terminology from that myth cycle that was developed by him and others, but it's also the thematic elements, which are in some sense far more important but a lot more difficult to enumerate. When you're talking about the idea of gods from the outside that threaten our reality and breaking in through the gate from the other side, etc., these are topoi, mythic topoi, that were actually developed by Lovecraft that have nothing to do with any myth system that was in place in the ancient world. They did not understand the world the way Lovecraft did. Lovecraft was, in some sense, a materialistic nihilist, and so his understanding of the forces of nature were that they were hostile to man. no mythic system had that approach to the world because they were not infused in that same culture of scientific nihilism that Lovecraft was. So if you look at the Sumerian mythos or its extension to Babylonian mythos, these beings like Tiamat and Absu and Kingu that were considered by the author of the Simon-Necronomicon to be ancient ones were not seen in the way that Lovecraft viewed Cthulhu and Azathoth, etc., as beings that were hostile to man's existence. Tiamat was a primordial beast that was slain in order to make the world, just like we find, you know, the Titans were slain by the Greek gods in order to make the current existential order. All these myth systems were operating from that same principle of trying to understand the nature of the order of the world. And so anything that was seen as pre-existing of the world was seen as chaotic and defeated, but not necessarily a threat to man's current existence. There was no cult of the return of Tiamat. That just didn't make any sense to this, well, actually the Babylonian paradigm.
Mr. Asylum?
Mr. King's rebuttal is very westernized. In the Magan text, it mentions Tiamat as the queen of the ghouls. The ghouls comes from the word jinn. And since the time of Muhammad, the jinn was said to coexist with mankind in a separate reality. Muslims also believe that the jinn will survive the world's last holocaust. So the idea of a separate set of beings who predated Adam, which is in the Muslim belief, you can go on Wikipedia and look up the jinn, who are said to be those who are fire, which is also mentioned in Necronomicon, the idea of them coming back and coming into existence and coming into power, it's metaphoric to those that don't know, but historically, it is chronicalized in the halls of Islam, the Islamic religion. And not for nothing, but the Sufic religion influenced Madame Blavatsky, Gurdjieff, as well as Crowley. All these people went through understanding some principles of Sufism before writing their grand grimoires. Now, later on, like during the 60s with LeVay and stuff, it got a little bit more away from that. But in the old days, this is what the prominent thought was. You can look that up in any place online. Now, where did the idea of the jinn come from? It definitely preceded Islam in its essence. A lot of the gate-walking rituals, walking around the talisman of each star the number of times it is similar to a Muslim performing Hajj and walking around the black stone that Muhammad is said to execute or terminate 360 idols that existed in it, many of which were the gods that are mentioned in the Simon-Necronomicon. This stuff predates the Western thought. So the idea that Lovecraft was like this great guru, I respect his work. He's a very intelligent man.
Mr. King?
Hey, with all due respect to the characterization of the jinn that was just given, it is actually alien to Islamic thought. The jinn were a separate race of beings, but they were mortal beings that were above us in power. They were not divine beings by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, jinn, by their very nature, were not necessarily evil spirits. There are jinn that worship Allah and hence are Muslims according to that tradition. But again, that is a hybrid tradition of East and West and is somewhat new with regard to the development of myths. We're talking about ancient Mesopotamian myths, and even in any of those, there is just no indication that they viewed the world the way either Lovecraft did or the way the authors of the Simon-Necronomicon did, which is that you have these cosmic forces that are hostile to man that seek to break into the current world order. That mythic topoi is just not present in any ancient mythic system. It came from Lovecraft. Even if you look at these ancient texts over and over and over again, you'll come to that same conclusion. You cannot provide a single instance of this mythic topoi in any text that has been verified. Now, granted, you can have esoteric understandings of things and such, but they did not share those same understandings. Within their culture, they were attempting to come to an understanding of the world and the meaning of the world, the meaning of existence, the meaning of the order of the world, which they did not understand scientifically, hence they needed a mythic understanding of it. I'll yield the rest of my time on this one.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Asylum.
Where are we now?
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to go into a little bit of a book that was pretty much written by archaeologists who had a chance to look at some of the Assyrian tablets in Nineveh
Francis Lernemont, he wrote the book Chaldean Magic and Its Origin. Anybody who's involved in economics and studies, they definitely purchased that book because they can see some relevance to the matter. But in the book, he's just coming from an archaeological standpoint. He mentions on several occasions how the Chaldeans will perform certain incantations and different things that we know now from the Moxley text, the modern version that was discovered, the one that doesn't appear in the Necronomicon, to ward off, to keep the gates closed from these beings that later became known in Islamic lore as jinn from entering the world. So this idea that Lovecraft has is not nothing new. It's simply even like can be seen in Catholicism, where someone is being possessed or exorcised, and the priest is trying to send it back. All that stuff came from the Chaldeans. You know, it wasn't that these people were not scientifically advanced to know what was happening. That was for the layman who just, you know, all that knowledge died off. But for the initiated individuals, they understood the process. The Chaldeans had numerical values.
Mr. King?
Okay, again, with all due respect, the jinn just are not understood that way. They are mortal beings. When we're talking about possession by demonic spirits, we're talking about demonic spirits. These are spirits which are like us but a little bit superior to us. They're not gods. This is a mythic paradigm that we're talking about here with regard to the Lovecraftian understanding of forces, divine forces. Well, that actually has to be read into it because Lovecraft did not really take the idea that they were divine, but in his mythic system, they take the roles of divine beings, and they are hostile. Breaking in from the other side is not to be understood in a small scale, as in with demonic possession, the individual soul, but in the Lovecraftian sense, the entire world order is corrupted by these beings coming from the outside. So we're talking about a difference in scale here. So we can talk all day long about, you know, individual demonic possessions or individual jinn. We are not talking about that mythic topoi that is, you know, in Lovecraft and in the Simon Necronomicon. Those are the only two places that you find it. You don't find it in ancient cultures. You just don't. I mean, I'm actually surprised that somebody could take that position. Even the Chaldean oracles of Zoroaster or whatever, you don't find that. Individual possession is not the same thing as the corruption of the world order. I mean, the closest parallel you could probably come up with regard to this idea would be the Norse paradigm, where you had the ancient beings, the giants in league with Loki, et cetera, who were attempting to overthrow the world order of Odin. But that has to probably be understood along a completely separate lines of their understanding of Valhalla, and that all good warriors had to die a certain kind of a death. And it wasn't really so much a
Mr. Asylum?
Yeah, I kind of agree with Mr. King that these were not necessarily divine beings in the sense that we kind of put it in, as even Gurdjieff would say, the scale of that man deals with does not connect him directly to divine light. But I want to kind of get to a passage dealing with demonic possession that is seen in the Simon Economic, and where it shows how the jinn correlate directly with some aspect of possession. Where it mentions in, I think it's page 49 of the time in Economics, on how the YouTube Zool will take possession of the soul until that soul is able to call down the spirit, and the normal spirit will return to its erstwhile neighborhood. And this shows how, metaphorically, it's clearly seen metaphorically, that possession was sometimes related to like an ancient one escaped and destroyed the sheep and ravaged all this sort of thing, but they were dealing with mental processes that occur within the body. Here it is. This is the verse on page 49. It says, and for that reason, the fearful Yutubzu take possession of the body and dwell therein until the priest banish them back from whence they came, and the normal spirit may return to the erstwhile neighborhood. So a lot of things in the Simon Necronomicon are written directly deal with the relationship between the jinn and man. In the Islamic world, it is a little bit religious out from the Abrahamic stems of religion, but amongst the Yazidis and all that sort of thing, who claim that their lineage comes from Adam but not that of Eve, which is also highlighted in the Sumerian dictionary, this all relates to the fact that the jinn as the beings which sometimes are perceived as peaceable people, have intermixed with human beings to create progeny, but were also responsible for man's inner creation. So the
Mr. King?
Again, all this is, you know, insightful from a certain perspective, but to put this whole debate resolution thing back in center focus is whether or not the book that we have, the Simon Necronomicon, is dependent on the mythos of H.P. Lovecraft, and I just see no other way around it. When you talk about Cthulhu, you know, good 22 times and then five other times spelled Cthulhu, and this is a being that is dreaming, that has been imprisoned, that is a divine wreaker of havoc that has to be prevented from entering into the world. That is exactly drawn from H.P. Lovecraft, and that is throughout the Simon Necronomicon. Now, granted, I concede that there are portions of that book that are not so influenced. As he mentioned, Mr. Asylum, the gatewalking rituals is absolutely 100% independent of the mythos of H.P. Lovecraft, but that is only one small part of the book. I mean, you take the Aurelia text, it's spelled differently, but it's actually phonetically identical to the Rilia text. It's spelled in such a way that if you read it, it's pronounced the exact same, but it's spelled with completely different consonants. Are we to assume that August Derleth did not actually invent that word? Well, actually, Lovecraft invented the word, but August Derleth invented the Rilia text. So are we to assume that these two men somehow conspired to make something up that was already in existence that nobody knew about? It just doesn't make any sense. What makes more sense is that the name of that book was taken from the writings of Derleth and Lovecraft without any credit given, except insofar as to say, well, these guys presaged our finding of this text that nobody's ever seen. Again, it's like the dog ate Simon's homework. We have no text that we can verify on this. All these myths that were taken out of context and then peppered with, you know, references to characters from H.P. Lovecraft, mythic Towboy from H.P. Lovecraft, themes from H.P. Lovecraft.
Mr. Asylum?
Mr. King brought up some valid points, but again, like you said, getting back to the centerpiece of the argument, the idea of beings returning from a paradigm that is outside of ours is even seen in Christianity, where God fell asleep on the seventh day. It's similar to Cthulhu, you know what I'm saying? The God that's dead but dreaming. And him and his armies, I guess, headed by his son Jesus Christ, not Christian, whatever, but I do know some of the biblical mythos, returning to destroy the world. That's much older than Lovecraft. That is much older than Lovecraft. So I don't agree with this idea that Lovecraft invented this whole paradigm that's a reflection of, in some ways, Christianity and some of the Abrahamic religious thoughts. However, if you look back into the child beings and what they really believe beyond the Oracle of Azoster, which is one of the few documents that we have left remaining by them, but even some of the surviving cults of the Sabians, the Yezidis, and things of that nature, they're very insightful in helping one to appreciate that these things existed before that. Like I was saying before in Chaldean Magic, Its Origin and Development, Mr. Lernemuth clearly states how the Chaldeans had every article of creation knowing its manifestation, and it would produce a number for that object. Objects that were considered demonic that didn't dwell in the sphere, they gave a negative connotation to, like minus 16 or whatever the case may be. These articles were highly banished, although at one time, going into LeVay's philosophy, they were older gods that preceded the Chaldeans that maybe have been used against them when they were trying to conquer different lands.
Okay, guys, this is your closing here. So, Mr. King?
Okay, real quick, with regard to Christianity, Abrahamic religions, there is no concept of a divine wreaker of havoc destroying the world. It's a monotheistic religion, after all, so everything is under the providence of the one God. This is, like, to me, is open and shut. I mean, you have a book that you can go to any bookstore and buy. You open it up. On the very front page is Cthulhu Calls. You read the thing through. It has references over and over again to characters from the story of H.P. Lovecraft, stories of H.P. Lovecraft, and others that operated within his same writing circle. You have mythic themes that were borrowed from H.P. Lovecraft, such as those breaking in from the outside, these hostile divine demonic forces that were not small-scale demons, but large-scale cosmic beings. That topos is derived from Lovecraft. It does not exist in any ancient culture. So there you have it. It's dependent on the mythos of H.P. Lovecraft. When you weed all those things out, what you're left with is a hodgepodge Mesopotamian grimoire that blends a lot of traditions together somewhat unsuccessfully and is useful maybe as a tool for initiation for some, but you have to discount large portions of the text in order to do so and say that somehow it's independent of H.P. Lovecraft. And I think that we do a disservice both to the artist H.P. Lovecraft and also to the myth makers of ancient Sumer and Babylon in saying that somehow their works were not independently created by the thinkers and artists that created them, and that somehow Lovecraft did not create his own creations.
Mr. Asylum?
Yeah, I'll have to disagree on some of those points, because it's clearly seen in Christianity that Jesus, who was a dead god, or whatever, was supposed to return back to destroy the world. But even going on to ancient mythology that preceded Lovecraft by thousands of years, let's go into Pazuzu. Pazuzu, in Babylonian Star Lore by Gavin White, he identified that this ancient Babylonians and Sumerians assigned Pazuzu to a constellation that is no longer seen on the northern horizon. So the idea of Lovecraft using mystic beings to simulate a very large emanation of whatever you want to call it, it can be seen in ancient mythology, whereas the people at that time period associate their deities with planets, stars, and constellations. That exists today in astrology. That's nothing new. You know what I'm saying? So I think that, you know, the elements of H.P. Lovecraft is in there. Portions of what they took from the grimoire that was illegal and merged in with Lovecraft was not in a way to put Lovecraft down, but was to validate, like, hey, this person was on to something. You know, like, we can see the relevance of what he's on to. That's Kenneth Grant's perspective and a lot of other magicians' perspectives who work with the dark current. I don't definitely see how the Simon Necronomicon, a lot of people who bought this home didn't even know who Lovecraft was. I experienced this personally as a teacher. You know, so, but it's not necessarily necessary that these people, I've seen people go through the gatewalking rituals and so forth and not know about Lovecraft. I try to encourage people to read some of the material because it can play relevance when you start researching who is Azathoth, and see the relevance. You can look at it when you look at the relevance of Cthulhu and look up the Chinese word Cthulhu spelled in the same exact way as it's spelled in the Simon Necronomicon. And then you can see the connection between the Arab world and the Asian world at one time that existed and the ruler who was called Cthulhu in history. This is historical stuff. Now, was...
Okay, and that actually brings the end of this debate. I want to personally thank both of you gentlemen for bringing very good arguments to the plate here. I think there's a lot for our listeners to consider. At this time, no, we need to start tallying votes. So you can either call in at 347-989-1371, or you can cast your vote in the chat room. I'm going to be tallying right now. If you do call in, a quick comment's allowed, but please let's keep it short. We have little time. So.
Also, I'm going to be starting a brand new thread on the Cult of Cthulhu forum. Just for people to basically respond and keep discussing this as long as people want to discuss it. You know, if you have an opinion or something, that's a good way to, you know, reinforce what we've already heard and just keep the arguments flowing.
Okay, let's start here on the switchboard. I believe... the Dark Fool is still hanging on the line, so we'll start with him. Dark Fool?
Wow. I'm at a loss for words. I don't know what to say. I mean, I really don't want to cast my vote. I really want to just stay impartial to this because, I mean, this is the first time I've really looked into the Simon Necronomicon, and I got to tell you that strong arguments on both sides.
Okay, so you're neutral. Thank you, then.
Very neutral.
All right, next up, next caller. Anybody? All right. In the chat room so far, we have 3 for King. None yet for Mr. Warlock Asylum. I'm sure that somebody will, at least one person, will have to see the relevance of his argument.
I was just going to say that Venus Satanis, even before she just wrote that, it seemed like she was siding with Warlock Asylum. And, you know, I hope that people take the whole debate, you know, I hope that people really consider all things that were stated. It seemed like a lot of people came in with a predetermined decision, or, you know, they knew who they were going to side with even before, you know, the battle, quote-unquote,
began. Right.
Yeah,
I agree.
So,
it's important definitely to keep an open mind.
Right.
I do believe that both Mr. King and Mr. Warlock Asylum both presented great arguments. I was really excited to hear how it went down.
Now, Master Zeno, I don't know if you want to, you know, if you want us to, you know, talk about what's... I mean, I have a few points I want to address, but
well,
if you don't want to use another show...
Moment, 1 second.
Okay.
Okay, caller, what's your vote?
Jason King.
Jason King?
Yep.
Okay.
I think...
Who are you?
G-Poke Tough from the forum.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it's the Necronomicon should be taken at face value for the individual who's reading them. Like, personally, I take incantations from there and I use them, but not in the sense that it's supposed to be used in that tome.
Okay.
To me, that sounds like you're more neutral. Or are you siding with King because you just think his argument was superior?
I think his argument was a lot more valid than the Warlock Asylum.
Okay.
I think he made a lot more points that made actual sense than rather than just trying to go back and forth. But, I think it should be just taken at face value. You really shouldn't put that much of a specific, you know, ground on it, whether it's real or whether it's not real. You should just use it for what you use it for. More of like a chaos kind of view on it. Excuse me?
Not reading too much into it beyond what, you know...
Yeah, just basically use them and adapt them to your kind of uses rather than using them specifically for what more or less it was intended for.
Okay, but in that regard, I think you could say that with probably 99% of magical or occult texts.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Right. Okay, well, that's good. Thanks for your response.
No problem. Have a good day, guys.
You too.
All right, good.
Okay, gentlemen, before me and Venger actually cast our straws, so to speak, I'd like to give you both the opportunity to cast your straw. Warlock Asylum, does your vote still stay with your point, or did Mr. King present enough for you to have to question it?
Well, I think Mr. King definitely, you know, spoke on what he believed in. He did some research into things, which is really useful. I think that I will have to keep my vote on my side of the deal simply for the fact that, you know, in all this thing with the Necronomicon, and I should say this because this is one reason why I kind of answered to the vote. I won't take up too much time, is that when the Necronomicon Files was written, I spoke to Holmes about this, you know, so we went over this. You can read it on the blog page. Practitioners of the tome wasn't really addressed in that. You know what I'm saying? And to come and tell a practitioner of the tome what's real and what's not real is like me going to Zimbabwe and telling these people how to work with voodoo. You know what I'm saying? They've been doing the rites for thousands of years and stuff like that. I don't know the inward workings and symbolism for what stuff means, but, you know, all I can do is sit back and, hey, if that works for you, I respect it. I respect Mr. King's work. I think that his book, Postmodern Satanism, if someone's in that school of thought or not in that school of thought and interested in Satanism, that should be one of the first books that you read. He's very clear. He's very concise. As far as the Necronomic Concurrent, another problem that worries me that a lot of voters or people listening online may not be aware of is I recently went to the Wikipedia page where it talks about using the second Simon Economic and suggests human sacrifice, which is a metaphor. It doesn't really suggest that. But the fact that I couldn't change that, and I was given an email telling me that if I go back and try to change that again, I would not have privileges on Wikipedia. My account would be deleted. This brings a message to me to the whole left-hand path community, because when you start debunking something as a hoax, which every page does, even pages that don't even deal with magic, you're setting up something for this to occur on all fields of the left-hand path. So that's really what my thing is. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We've got another caller. Let's try to take a vote. Caller?
Yes.
Your vote?
I understand that the statement is that the Simon Necronomicon is dependent on the mythos of H.P. Lovecraft.
That's correct.
I think that the statement is unclear, and that I like Mr. Warlock's presentation because it makes it clear that it's not dependent for practical uses, and it may be dependent for other purposes. I loved Jason's argument and was persuaded by him, but I would vote for Mr. Warlock because I think that for practical purposes, it's not dependent on H.P. Lovecraft. In fact, the emphasis on the mythos amongst H.P. Lovecraft fans is variable.
Okay. We appreciate that. We're running short on time, though, so thank you, sir.
Sure.
All right. Jason, do you have... you want to cast your straw?
Well, I mean, who votes against himself? If I vote against myself, that should probably be counted as, like, 8 votes against me.
That is true.
Again, Mr. Asylum has a lot of interesting things to present, but to me, the resolution is open and shut. I mean, you can find ancient traditions which mirror certain things, but at the end of the day, the influence is through and through the book. I mean, you just have to pick it up, open it up, inside front cover, introduction, testimony to Matt Arab reads like a H.P. Lovecraft story, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to restate arguments over again, but it just, to me, is open and shut.
All right, and now for, I guess, the final countdown here. Benjamin, do you you want to start or you want me to?
Well, I think maybe some attention should be given to the meaning or how we use the word dependent. It sounds like enough hairs are being split where the meaning of that one word, dependent, is, you know, understanding that and whose interpretation and you know, subjective understanding of the word dependent is, you know, everything revolves around that. The only other thing I'll say is that I do have a lot of other things that I want to comment regarding the debate, and you know, I definitely don't have any time for that. So I'm going to be posting that, like everything that I want to talk about, on the new thread that I'm going to start as soon as the show is over. So please, everybody, go to the Cult of Cthulhu forum. I guess I would have to say I'm neutral because I just can't get into it now. I just don't have enough time.
All right. Okay, so you're going with neutral. Real quick, you guys both gave a great argument. I don't want to take anything away by me making my statement of opinion, but by basis of logic, I have to vote for Jason King. I feel, Mr. Asylum, that you failed on several different levels of reason, and you crossed multiple logical fallacies, such as appeal to authority, appeal to common practice. I would even happen to say novelty would be one of the appeals that you made. I could probably write a book on itself on my critique with your argument in this debate, but I don't want to take away from the validity of the actual spirituality of it. I think that what you got going on now that I'm hearing your presentation of it is definitely a very workable system, and I'm intrigued. And that's a tough thing to do. With all that being said, we got about 10 seconds left. Mr. King, you with a 6-4 ratio, you took the debate. And everybody check out CultOfCthulhu.net.
I want to say thanks to everybody. Thanks to Warlock Hassan for doing this. I think we elevated the dialogue, and that's what we need. So
yeah, so I'd just say thank everybody as well. You're welcome, Mr. King.
Yep. Thanks both of you, and thanks BZL for putting this, or helping to put all this together. It's been a good show.
Awesome. Well, okay. I will definitely be seeing you guys around the internet.
Yep. I'm off to the forum. Adios.
Okay. Take care. Have a good day.